Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. Happy Thursday to you. I'm Lauren Gilger here with Mark Brody in Phoenix. Thanks for joining us. Coming up on the show, pro-police supporters filled last night's Phoenix City Council meeting. We'll hear from one council member and a former police officer on both sides of this issue. And the U.S. Supreme Court just came down with a ruling on the census citizenship question. We'll hear more about that.
But first this hour, the U.S. Senate yesterday approved a $4.6 billion package intended to help alleviate the humanitarian crisis at the country's southern border. Among other things, the money would pay for shelters for children in federal custody, to speed up immigration cases, and reimburse cities and states for costs they've incurred. The Senate's action came a day after the House passed its own bill. The dollar amount was roughly the same, but several other provisions were different, including new health and safety standards for children in custody. The two chambers are now working to figure out what to do next. The Federal Department of Health and Human Services has said it expects to run out of money for housing migrant children in the next few days. Arizona Senator Martha McSally was among the 84 senators who supported that chamber's version. I spoke with her yesterday shortly after the vote and asked her how big of a dent that measure could potentially put in the current crisis at the border.
Well, I'm glad to see a strong bipartisan vote on this. It's long overdue. I've been advocating for it for weeks. Our Border Patrol and frontline agents and local communities have been overwhelmed by this crisis. This is going to put a Band-Aid on it. It's going to provide the resources needed to reimburse, in some cases, to provide for the shelter and the immigration judges and food and transportation to deal with the crisis. But it's not going to solve the long-term cause of the crisis. Only my legislation that I have with Lindsey Graham, if the Democrats come to the table, will actually solve the root causes of why this illegal activity keeps growing and growing every single month. But it's going to provide the necessary relief that our frontline agents need right now.
How much relief? I mean, how long do you think that the money in this bill can be stretched?
Well, it's hard to tell. They've already taken significant costs out of hide amongst the agencies. We've moved agents from ports of entry to support, TSA agents, other accounts. Again, local communities have taken the brunt of it. But what we've seen is the illegal activity went from 100,000 to 109,000 to 144,000. And so unless we close these loopholes, this curve is going to keep going higher as more people take the dangerous journey, more kids are trafficked, and more cartels put money in their pockets to profit from it.
Among many other differences, a version of this bill that the House passed earlier this week would have restored some aid to Central American countries where a lot of these families are coming from. Do you think that's a worthwhile thing for the U.S. to be involved in?
Well, I think we owe it to our taxpayers, our hardworking Arizonans and Americans, that we're good stewards of the resources. And when we do make investments in other places, it's tied to our national interest. There's accountability. It makes sense. There's other entities, international organizations, nonprofits, and others that are involved in the region. And ultimately, their government needs to be accountable to their people to provide opportunity for people. And so that's happening in many places in the world. On our part, we do get to control who comes into our country. We are very generous with our legal immigration system. You have people cheating the system, and they're abusing the process that we have, and that's what needs to stop.
So what do you think happens next? I mean, obviously the Senate has a bill, the House has a bill. There's some confusion as to whether there might try to be a conference committee or whether the House will just vote on the Senate bill. Do you have a sense of what happens next?
We'll see. Those conversations are going on as we speak. We've got a couple more days in this session, and we got to get something to the president's desk. I would encourage the House to take up our bill. We had over 80 senators vote for it. It was a strong bipartisan bill. It addresses the current crisis, and they should pass it and get it to the president's desk.
I'm interested in the fact that it was so bipartisan. 84 senators voted for this. Immigration is not usually an issue on which you expect a lot of bipartisanship. I'm wondering what you think led to that.
Well, a lot of hard work by many of us in order to get the facts out there of what this was. It's providing the needed relief to solve the humanitarian crisis, plus getting to the root causes of some of it with more immigration judges. Again, more support to our agents who are taking this cost out of Hyde. And so I'm glad to see that we had a number of senators on the other side of the aisle look at it factually and not through the political hyperbole and get it out of the Senate in a strong way.
Let me ask you about one other issue, if I may, and that is the president's endorsement of your reelection campaign, which came just the other day here. He said he gives you his complete and total endorsement. In a political environment such as we are right now, what does that do for you?
Well, I'm grateful for his endorsement. I was just in the White House yesterday there for an initiative that's going to help address the cost of affordable housing, which is really important for Arizonans. We need to unite as Republicans, and I need others who are independents and Democrats who are open-minded to see me as their senator and what I'm doing to fight for them. I'm independent-minded. I'm supporting and fighting for Arizona. I've already been able to get the drought contingency plan for the Colorado River signed into law. I'm leading to protect our military bases and supporting our veterans, leading on many issues that matter to all Arizonans, regardless of their party. So my hope is that they see me as a person who served in the military 26 years, who's been fighting for women's rights, who's been fighting for Arizona, and give me the opportunity to continue to serve and be able to take a fresh look that's not based on what they heard or from the attack ads in the last campaign, but what I've actually done for Arizona since I've been in the Senate. And I'm going to be tirelessly working for them. The campaign will come later. For crying out loud, I feel like we just got out of the last one. People are tired of it. So am I. Now's my time to serve.
In a state, though, where the president's approval ratings have fairly consistently been below 50%, are you concerned at all that having him endorse you in this way might hurt you among independents and maybe Republicans who aren't enamored of the president?
Well, I think, again, it was an important step for us to unite and focus on moving forward. And that's really what it was about. And I give the opportunity for any Democrat who's open-minded and independent to see my record, see what I've done in my life, and see what I'm doing in the Senate, and have an opinion on me as their senator that can also be independent of their opinion on anybody else. And so I think it's important for us to unify, and I'm grateful for it.
One last issue before I let you go, and that is the issue of Iran. The tensions seemingly have been ramping up between the U.S. and Iran over the past couple of weeks. There's a debate in Congress as to what the president should or should not be allowed to do on his own without congressional approval. Where do you fall on that? Obviously, you have that military background. Where do you fall on what the president can do on their own and what Congress needs to approve?
Well, the maximum pressure campaign on Iran needs to continue. The sanctions, the diplomacy, the return to deterrence is what our objective needs to be. We're in a co-equal branch of the government, but only one person is the commander-in-chief. And I feel strongly that in order to make sure that Americans and our troops who are deployed have very clear guidance as to when they can take action to protect their other troops or protect their wingmen, that there's very clear understanding of what the rules of engagement are. And that lies initially with the commander-in-chief. We do have the War Powers Act for sustained engagement, but that inherent right of self-defense, and that needs to not be blurred. And so let's leave the authority where it has been. And if there's a sustained engagement on any front, then Congress certainly has a voice.
All right. That's Arizona Senator Martha McSally. Senator McSally, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
In a stark change from last week's city council meeting, it was a pro-police supporters who filled the council chambers last night at City Hall.
This is a war on police.
We just really need to support our police officers.
This comes a week after a video was released showing a Phoenix officer cursing and pointing guns at a family suspected of shoplifting. The video prompted a flurry of condemnation from the community and an apology from the Phoenix police chief and the mayor. Last night, supporters did not condone the actions of the officers in that viral video. However, they expressed clear concerns that there is a growing war on Phoenix's police. We'll hear more about their concerns in a moment, but we first turn to Phoenix City Council member Carlos Garcia. Garcia has been an activist for police reform for more than a decade and is calling for the creation of a civilian review board to act as a check on police. Similar efforts have failed in the past, but when we sat down in his office yesterday, Garcia told me it's different this time.
What we saw in the video, what we saw in the Facebook post is not surprising to me because I've been dealing and working with the families that have been impacted by this police department for a long time. And I've had to hear their stories and how they were treated and the abuse that they went through. And unfortunately, some families that lost loved ones at the hands of police. And so this wasn't a surprise. I think what is a little bit of a surprise, but it's a welcome surprise, is the attention that this video got, not only here in Phoenix, but across the country and internationally. And I think when these windows happen, it's important for us to step up and hopefully have impactful change that can curve what we've seen in Phoenix.
So let's talk a little bit about this. I want to start with the last city council meeting. So many activists were dismayed when the budget passed and gave a lot more money to the Phoenix Police Department. So given how critical you've been of Phoenix PD over the years, why did you vote for it?
I think the budget vote is important for people to understand that it has a lot more to do than just police. And it's actually some good police accountability work that was within the budget that was important to be implemented as soon as possible. One of those things was a trauma fund. And so as it stands, when families or communities are impacted by police violence, the city of Phoenix is not responsible in their support. One of the things that's included in this budget is actually funds to support those families and support them in getting counseling and getting those sorts of services. And so there's hundreds of programs that were depending on this budget to start on July 1st. I guess the exchange in order to vote for this budget was to get the commitment from the mayor to get a civilian review board and an ad hoc committee that's going to deal with this issue.
So I want to talk about that committee. This is not the first time something like this has been suggested. Getting an actual civilian review board of the Phoenix Police, though, has not been successful before. What do you think is different this time?
I mean, we've been fighting for it for 10 years. And then I've talked to someone yesterday who said they've been trying to get it done for 30 years. So it's not something that the city's been welcoming to. I think what's going to be important and what makes it different now is the attention we've gotten. And hopefully people who've been elected, including myself and others, who understand the community's plight and what they've gone through at the hands of police. For this review board to be effective, it does need subpoena power. It does need certain powers that go beyond just review, but actually being able to bring testimony, be able to also encourage the police department to change practices and also make the public aware of what's happening inside the police department. What we can't have happen is what's happening now is the police policing themselves and not being able to hold them accountable.
So that's then your response to criticisms by groups like PLEA, some of the unions representing police officers who say, like, I don't know what a civilian review board would accomplish that isn't already being accomplished by current mechanisms. Would this be like a civilian review board would theoretically have the power to tell the department to fire a certain officer?
Yes, I think the review board needs to have that power. There needs to be consequences for police officers. What we've seen is impunity by police officers who've been involved in police-involved shootings or abuse cases like the ones we saw. I think we need to, for PLEA and supporters of PLEA, kind of flip the argument right back to them. What is it that you're afraid of? Why would you be afraid of civilians actually wanting to make the department better and make sure that they're not abusing their power, make sure that they're not murdering people that they shouldn't be? And so I think it's important to have accountability and transparency. And I think it's concerning to think that an entire police department and an entire community does not want transparency, does not want us to know what's actually happening in these situations. And so I think it's common sense. Even the T-shirt I wore last week brought some controversy, and it said nothing but end police brutality. And I don't understand how people can be against ending brutality. We're not saying end police, we're not saying anything else, but to end the brutality and end the abuse at the hands of police.
I'm guessing the response from that would be that they feel attacked in the sense. They feel like this wouldn't be a fair review process. These are people who don't like police, whatever they do. How would you choose who's on the committee? How would you ensure the fairness there?
I think who's on the committee needs to have the trust of community. I think it would be really impactful for there to be someone who went through a police abuse or violence situation. I think there's experts out there. I think there's, you know, I was hearing your show a couple of days ago, and I saw a restaurant owner who had an amazing analysis of what's happening, right? And I'm not saying he's the one, but I think there's people out there who want to make the police department better, who aren't necessarily polarizing people, but are people that are concerned about the community and concerned about the violence at the hands of police.
We had Phoenix Police Chief Jerry Williams on our show a couple of weeks ago after the story came out that broke national news about police officers in many departments, including Phoenix PD, posting some controversial things on their inflammatory things on their social media accounts. And I asked her at the time if she thought that this pointed to a broader culture problem within her department. And she said no. She thought that this was a few bad apples. The Governor Doug Ducey said the same thing recently. What's your response to that?
She may be right. I would argue different. I would say it's an entire culture. And what I would point to that culture is those police officers that made those posts, including the police officers that were around the family that didn't report it, they all play a role in it, whether it's a silent role, whether it's a role of allowing these comments to be made around them, those things point to a culture. And that's a culture of there might be, in what the chief is saying, a couple of people that are doing these things, but everyone else is allowing it. And that is what a culture is. And I think it's a culture of racism, as we saw in the post, and it's a culture of abuse and impunity that allows people to get away with things that they shouldn't be getting away with. And I hope the chief recognizes it as such and addresses it as such.
Phoenix City Council Member Carlos Garcia, thank you.
Thank you so much.
One of those who is closely following the Phoenix Police controversy and its impact on law enforcement and community is Kevin Robinson, a retired assistant Phoenix Police chief who chaired the department's disciplinary review board for 13 years. Robinson is also a lecturer at the ASU School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. Good morning, Kevin.
Hey, good morning.
So I want to start with this idea of a civilian review board. So you chaired the internal review board then for some time. What do you make of that idea?
Well, I understand. I understand the concern that folks have. But what people have to understand, or what they should understand, is that we have had, within the Phoenix Police Department, civilian input and oversight for going back almost, at least, I would say about 30 years, where civilians, folks from the general community in Phoenix, sit on our, not just the disciplinary review board, but the use of force board. The use of force board determines whether or not people are in or out of policy in any kind of force that they use. And the disciplinary review board is just that. When an officer or any employee within the police department has found to violate department policy, they go before that board and they run up against being fired, demoted, suspended. There's a host of discipline that they run into.
So would this be different, though, having a separate independent review board made up of citizens who could have things like Councilman Garcia suggested, subpoena power, the ability to fire officers, et cetera?
Well, those types of boards have been tried in other cities with other police departments with varying levels of success. The question begs to be asked, does it need to go that far? Is there a belief that the department is so bad that you need to have civilian oversight? And of course, some are going to say, most definitely, look at what's going on. And others are going to say, no, this is an anomaly. It doesn't happen all the time. And that's what folks have to sit back and consider. There are literally thousands of police contacts going on just today alone. Thousands of Phoenix police officers will make thousands of contacts.
So this goes to that question that, yeah, so this goes to that question then of a broader culture problem that I spoke with Councilmember Garcia about and that we also asked the chief about a few weeks ago. He says that this is definitely pointing to a culture in the Phoenix police of racism, of impunity. Do you disagree? Do you think this is just a few bad apples?
I disagree. It is a few bad apples because in my time within the organization, and I've been gone for 2 years now, and I don't think a whole lot has changed since then. But during my time, when racism, Any kind of hate or any kind of, you know, that type of attitude, whenever it emerged, and it did, as long as we hire from the human race, you're going to have problems. When it did emerge, it was dealt with immediately. And that's what I think people really have to sit back and look at and take a hard look. And the police department will do the same thing, because maybe there is room for improvement. But my experience has told me over 36 and a half years, when something happened, when something was said, somebody was involved in something, the department dealt with it.
So then what do you say to the fact that this seems to continue to happen? There seem to be more videos like this, more encounters like this, more lawsuits. There's also right now a woman claiming that she was sexually assaulted because of a cavity search by Phoenix PD. What about the pattern that seems to be emerging there?
It's unfortunate, and you have to sit back and think to yourself, you know, is there a problem? And that's where I get where people are coming from. Mm-hmm. I understand completely and totally, because when it rains, it pours, and it appears to be pouring right now. My experience tells me that these are one-offs, and I know some people will not be happy with me saying something like that. It's not indicative of the Phoenix Police Department that I know. And I've talked to current officers, past officers, and the kids that I teach, I say kids for lack of a better word, but the kids I teach at ASU who are going to be future officers, I don't see those types of attitudes, and I don't see anybody wanting to accept those types of behaviors or attitudes who want to be police officers.
All right. That's Kevin Robinson, former assistant Phoenix police chief and a lecturer at the ASU School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And next week, Mayor Kate Gallego announced city leaders will come together to address growing concerns over actions by the Phoenix Police Department. We'll bring you coverage of that when it happens.
The U.S. Supreme Court has blocked the citizenship question from the 2020 census, at least for now. The majority said it, quote, cannot ignore the disconnect between the decision made and the explanation given, end quote, by the Trump administration. The decision could have huge political consequences, but there are other cases dealing with this issue still working their way through the courts. Here to help us sort out this ruling and what it means is Kelly Percival, counsel with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Hi, Kelly.
Hi.
So how significant is this ruling, especially given that this may or may not actually be the last word?
Well, it is significant for now, but I would call it a temporary win for now that blocks the question, and it upholds parts of the lower court's decision, basically finding that the government has been lying for the reason that it wanted to add the citizenship question.
Now, am I right that this is based on some of those new documents that have been found that some of the lower court cases are dealing with that basically point to a more partisan nature for this question?
So I think that's what the justices probably had in the back of their mind, but that is actually not something that they pointed to in today's decision, because that evidence technically isn't before the court. It wasn't part of the administrative record in this case because it came to light too late. But it certainly shows what the administration's real reason was, which, like you said, was redistricting purposes, when the whole course of the litigation, they've been claiming that they want the question for voting rights enforcement.
So how does it actually work that the Supreme Court has ruled on this case, but as we've talked about, there are other cases still pending in lower courts? Like, how does that all work in terms of what actually a final decision might be?
Sure. That's a great question. So today's decision leaves in place the injunction from the district court in New York. But there are parallel cases, particularly there's one in Maryland right now that is reconsidering the equal protection claim that the plaintiffs had brought, claiming that the Trump administration added the citizenship question in order to intentionally discriminate against Hispanic communities. And that is a claim that the Supreme Court, it wasn't before the Supreme Court today. So that was nowhere in their decision. And regardless of what happens with the New York case, that Maryland case is going to continue and could provide a second ground for an injunction if the court finds that there was intentional discrimination.
There is a deadline, though, here, right? I mean, at some point, census forms have to be printed and the work has to start, and this question is either on or off, right?
Absolutely. And the administration has been saying that deadline is the end of June, so just a few days from now. But there have been other documents and other hints that they could potentially push that deadline through until October 31st. But you're right, the clock is ticking. There really isn't that much time for them to try to come up with a new reason for needing this question, and putting together a new administrative record and going through all those hoops. The census is coming up quick.
Well, even if the deadline is, in fact, October, does that give the Supreme Court enough time to hear arguments and make a decision?
You know, it's unusual, but they could decide to take the case in some sort of emergency hearing in September and issue a decision quickly. It wouldn't be the first time, but it is a very unusual proceeding.
All right. That is Kelly Percival, counsel with the Brennan Center's Democracy Program. Kelly, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Valley Democrats gathered last night at a Scottsdale movie theater to watch the first presidential primary debate. NPR's Don Gagne was there to watch with them, and he joins me. So, Don, first off, about how many people were there, and who are these folks who came to watch?
I'd say they were 100, maybe 120 people there, tops. They had a little bigger theater than they say they anticipated having. So there were still some empty seats, but a crowd of about 120, most of them Democratic activists, people who are, if they're not deeply involved with the party, they got mobilized after 2016. And it was, I can tell you, it was people who are really ready for 2020 to get here and ready for the opportunity to do whatever work they feel they need to do to, you know, to keep up the momentum they had in 2018. And everybody in that room that I talked to wanted to say farewell to Donald Trump come next year.
Any particular issues that these folks were excited to hear about or afterwards were glad to have heard about?
I think they were just glad to hear the range of issues that did come up. But after the first break, when there was an early kind of flurry back and forth on health care, you know, I talked to one woman in the audience, a retiree from Scottsdale, who said health care is item number one. And then she also kind of listed, you know, immigration and the economy as I'm going to mix up the order here, but as one A and one B. But you would get cheers kind of throughout as a new topic came up and as somebody delivered, you know, kind of a pointed remark or a punchline or whatever it was on those topics.
Did you hear anybody talk about the fact that there are so many candidates? I mean, there's been so much chatter about, you know, two nights with 10 each, and that's not even all the candidates. Did anybody express concern that maybe there are just too many folks running for the nomination?
They recognized why there are so many, right? But there was some frustration. You know, one guy said, let's get it down to 15 and then maybe we could do one. That's it, down to 15.
Wow.
Exactly. You know, and, you know, others said, well, it's too crowded and nobody's getting enough time. But they were pleased by some of the interactions that they saw and they heard. And, you know, one gentleman said to me, I was glad to hear Julian Castro go on at length about immigration. And, you know, I was very fascinated to hear what Bill de Blasio had to say, what Mayor de Blasio had to say about foreign policy, because I've paid no attention to him at all. And I found that interesting. So they were kind of two minds. Happy to hear, happy to learn, happy to absorb, but wishing it was a much less unwieldy field.
Don, obviously 10 more candidates are going to be debating tonight, similar format from Miami. You're not going to be in a movie theater, but you will be watching with Maricopa County residents, right?
That's right. And, you know, and I'm here because Arizona has really emerged as one of those interesting states to watch come next year. It's you know, it's gone Republican, what I think I said on the air this morning on NPR, 16 of the last 17 times. Mm-hmm. Or something like that. But there is a mood among Democrats that they've got a shot, which is why I came here to kind of see how those Democrats feel right now as this is all being sorted out. So last night was the big event. Tonight I'll be at a smaller event in Phoenix in somebody's living room. So maybe a dozen people. I think it'll be a younger crowd. And it'll be easier to get react in real time when somebody says something, because I'll be seated, you know, right on the couch next to them with my microphone rolling.
All right. We will listen to that reporting on NPR. That's NPR's Don Gagne in the Valley to watch the Democratic primary debates with Democratic voters here in Maricopa County. Don, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Good Thursday morning. It's the show here on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Lauren Gilger.
The Arizona Attorney General's office is going after companies behind those annoying, unsolicited phone calls we all get. It's part of a national effort involving the Federal Trade Commission and two dozen other state and local agencies called Operation Call It Quits. The campaign includes legal action against companies who are breaking the law and an education component to help people avoid the calls and protect them from getting ripped off. For more on this, I got a hold of Doug Shadell, a former fraud investigator and one of the nation's leading experts on robocalls and telemarketing fraud. Shadell is director of the AARP for the state of Washington. And we began our conversation with the problem. Is it just me, or are there more robocalls out there than there used to be?
Well, there's no question that the volume of robocalls is expanding dramatically. One estimate is that in 2017, there were 30 billion calls coming into the United States, robodials. That number in 2018 was 48 billion, and it's about 5 billion a month now in 2019. So just the raw numbers are gigantic, and that's why everybody is annoyed by them, I think.
Yes, we are certainly all annoyed by them. But why are they so difficult to stop? I mean, we hear a lot about efforts to try and stop this by government, by phone companies, et cetera, but it doesn't seem to do anything.
I think there's a couple reasons. One is technology has just made it so inexpensive to send massive numbers of these calls out, and they come from all over the world. They're not just coming from, you know, New York or Los Angeles, but you could be anywhere and do this kind of robo-dialing work. That's one thing. Another thing is I think the phone companies have felt constrained by which ones do we stop? How do we know which ones are legal and which ones are illegal? And if you start, you know, blocking calls that are legitimate, that exposes them to some liability. We've been telling our folks that one real short-term solution, at least, you know, I told a group this yesterday, is to try and get some kind of a call blocking service, whether it's Nomo Robo or a Umail or a Robo Killer. There are a number of apps that you can install that will take care of a lot of it, not 100%, but 95 to 98% of it.
And the risk for phone companies there is that, like you said, they will block legitimate calls coming through, like something from your pharmacy. Is that the concern?
Yeah, or just anybody who might say, how come you're blocking my call? I'm not an illegal robo-dialer. And some of the work that the FCC is doing now would protect them from that liability, and maybe even get to a place where a consumer would have to opt out. There would be an automatic blocking going on. And you could opt out if you're concerned that calls are coming in that you want, but that would cut a lot of them out also. And it would mean that you wouldn't have to have a third-party blocking app to stop the calls. Our concern has been the number of those calls, quite frankly, that are frauds, that are scams. And we did a survey, a national survey about 2 months ago, where we tried to gauge the extent to which people are responding to some of these calls, you know, things like there's something wrong with your Social Security card or you owe the IRS money. And one of the things we found is there are a lot more fear appeals in these robo-dialers now, imitating government agencies. But it used to be that it was like, hey, you've won a prize, something like that. A lot of them now are just, you're going to get arrested if you don't give me $900.
I've definitely gotten that call, something along those lines. So that was the other question. So robocalls, like as a nuisance, is one thing, but the real effect of this is cumulative, right? Like lots of people are actually getting defrauded and spending money this way.
Right. Well, there's sort of these two trends. One is we're seeing more and more robodials that use fear to get you to pick up the call. And in our survey, people are more likely to pick up that call if it's a fear appeal. The other thing is we are trying to educate our members and the public in general that you can no longer rely on caller ID to determine who's calling. This is another problem because it is so easy to spoof the number. I mean, we are just completing a campaign out here in Washington now called Spoof Proof Your Life. In our survey, we asked people the question, how likely would you be to pick up the call if the caller ID said it was a toll-free number? One in five. How likely would you be to pick up that same call if it was a local area code in mm-hmm. your area? 6 out of 10 would pick that call up, right? So you get a lot of people who are still relying on that caller ID, and the scammers and the robo-dialers are all just spoofing all those numbers. The number that comes in over caller ID almost means nothing nowadays because they're all making it look like it's coming from your local area. We had 6 out of 10 people responding to our survey said that in the last 30 days, they had picked up a call thinking it was local, only to find that it was some kind of a salesman or some kind of a scam.
Okay, so now the FTC and 25 state and local agencies, including those here in Arizona, are unveiling this sort of crackdown operation on robocalls. This is called Operation Call It Quits. What exactly will this do, in your opinion? Will it be effective?
Well, I mean, I think there are these sort of policy changes that are going on. The law enforcement community is trying to shut down as many of these as possible, but they will all tell you the same thing, which is kind of a game of whack-a-mole. You shut down one, you find another one coming in somewhere else. But I think the combination of those things, and the third element, which is what we're doing at AARP, is the education piece, which is to teach people, here's what spoofing is, here's how to get a third-party call blocking thing if you need it. The combination of all those things has some potential. It's never going to be just one thing that's going to stop this.
So it sounds like this isn't going anywhere, no matter what government, phone companies, and how much education we all have. It's just a matter of continuing to fight it on various fronts?
I think so. I mean, I think that's right. Until somebody comes up with a magic technological bullet, which could happen, and some of the call blocking services are very clever in how they do this. One of them purchased 250,000 old telephone lines, and the phone continues to ring into a computer, and that's how they identify robocallers. And they're identifying 1,000 new robocallers a day. And so what happens is they create a blacklist. Then when you sign up with this app, when a call comes into your phone, they compare it to the blacklist. If there's a match, it blocks it. If there's no match, it lets it through. That blocks like 98% of the robocalls coming through. So there are technological solutions that are chipping away at this problem. But like you said, I don't think it's going to be any one thing.
All right. That's Doug Shadell, Washington State Director of AARP, a former fraud investigator and a telemarketing fraud expert. Doug, thank you for joining us on the show this morning.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Lauren Gilger and Steve Goldstein.
June is a vital time when it comes to recognizing the equal rights of the LGBTQ community in the U.S. And this month marks the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots that got Pride parades and Pride Month started in this country. Thanks to archival and more anecdotal research, a great deal more is being learned about how impactful gays and lesbians were in Arizona history, even as many of those residents weren't able to be open about their sexuality. The man known as the hip historian, Marshall Shore, has been working with a team from ASU to document the stories of the LGBTQ community, and he's with me to talk about his work. So, Marshall, looking through the archives, what stands out about how Arizona was impacted by Stonewall in the late 1960s and early 70s?
Well, I mean, you really find at that point, you have a handful of bars that start opening up at that point. You finally have people who are tired of sitting in the shadows, even though it doesn't show up in newsprint for about another year here in Arizona. Mm-hmm. I mean, news traveled at a very different pace than it does now. And so it took a while to get here, so it was more word of mouth. I mean, I've met people who didn't realize Stonewall happened until the 25th anniversary of it.
Really?
Yeah, just because there was it didn't show up on the nightly news. It didn't show up in the newspaper, so they didn't hear about it.
Mm-hmm. Was Arizona a place that was any less welcoming to people who are gay or lesbian?
I would say it was probably equally hospitable. Probably more nor less. Maybe because of like the Wild West nature. Maybe a little bit more, but it's hard to say. Because, I mean, you still find all these things kind of hiding, and it's like, oh, my gosh.
Is there a point in time, from looking through the archives, that you were even surprised that maybe certain things were in the newspaper? Or were there, I don't know, euphemisms for things that may give people a clue as to maybe what was going on because things were not out in the open in the same sense? If there was something related to someone was involved in a situation and maybe there was some code word for it happened in a situation where gay people were there or something like that.
Well, it was interesting. One of the things I was surprised about was finding ads for Ray Bourbon, Lee Leonard, who were drag queens. Okay. in the 50s. And so, I mean, Ray Bourbon was a nationally famous drag queen and did performing here and in Tucson. And then Lee Leonard was from Phoenix and found an ad for him in Globe.
In Globe, really?
I can't imagine performing drag at a bar in Globe in the 50s.
Right. I was even thinking before that, with the as a mining town, maybe you would have seen that, perhaps. Again,
well, and actually
you did.
Actually, one of the first Hollywood celebrities was actually a drag queen. Basically, his character was he would show up somewhere as a man and almost always, like a birdcage, have a reason why he had to dress as a woman. Julian Etang. And so he built one of the first Hollywood mansions. He was in a dozen silent movies and also did stage productions and was here in Arizona on stage in Phoenix and Tucson, but appeared on movie screens all over the state.
Did white males dominate when it came to knowing about news about people who are gay or whatnot? Is there a lack of knowledge about the diversity around that?
There is, and that's because of the media, because it was reporting on basically white men. And so when you start looking at marginalized communities, their stories don't necessarily make it into that print. Also, what winds up happening is it's very negative. You start until the mid-70s, you don't have LGBTQ press by the community, for the community. Mm. Until then, it's general press basically talking about the community.
Okay.
And so it's really those extremes that they wind up talking about, not just, hey, you know, so-and-so is having a party. But it's like, oh, there was an arrest here, this was going on. And in the 70s, that started changing a little bit, but it was still very white-centric.
Mm, okay. Was the history less preserved because of the specter or whatever over being able to be out in the open about these things?
Well, and it was such a close community. Mm. It was like you would find it was really popular to have house parties. So that way, all the folks that were there were already vetted. It's like you didn't have to figure out, okay, who's here, who's not here. Boom, everyone at this party is a friend. With that, that community stays in those photo albums. Like recently chatting with a gentleman who's now 93, we were talking about an artist, George Quaintance. George Quaintance was the art director for a lot of those muscle magazines in the 50s.
Okay.
And he did a lot of that from right here in Phoenix, in his house. And we were chatting about him, and he's like, well, you know, he never painted me, but this guy started rummaging around on his coffee table and found this little 1x2 photograph of a guy named Joe from Prescott standing next to this young man in drag. He's like, oh, this is one of George's boyfriends. And it was so shocking to see that photo because both the men are Hispanic.
Mm.
And so trying to get some of those stories is fairly difficult. And now to have a photo with a, now we have a name. So I just got that last week. So it's trying to figure out, okay, so now let's see what we can find out about the guy that we do know his name of.
Wow. This is such an obvious question, but I have to ask it anyway. Why is it important for this to be more available, more open, increasing the knowledge of people generally?
Well, it's interesting. I did a program recently at a library, and there was a 15-year-old young man in the back. And after the program was done, he came up and he was like, you know, I thought this was going to be a boring program because Arizona, what would be here? And he said he was shocked to find out his home state had so much LGBTQ history right here. Uh-huh. And so I'm sure he then ran off and told his friends because it's kind of like he thought it was just this small piece of history. Yeah. And finding out that there's this huge swath of history. So it gives a better context for where he's at. There's also this element of you're not alone. Other people have been here. They've survived through this. You will do the same.
Mm-hmm.
As well as that understanding element of looking at the community and realizing, oh, it's been here for a while. I've got a young friend who his parents are like, oh, you know, you're just this way because it's a fad. It's a new thing.
Hmm.
No, actually, even within Arizona, we can look at it really far back.
Marshall Shore is the hip historian, and he's working to document the stories of Arizona's LGBTQ community over the course of the state's history.
Arizona's arts advocacy organization is getting a new leader. After more than a decade with Arizona Citizens for the Arts, including 8 as its executive director, Rusty Foley is retiring at the end of the month. Her replacement will be Joseph Benish, who most recently has served as director of Phoenix Center for the Arts. Benish and Foley join me. And Rusty, let me start with you on this. I'm curious how you think Arizona does in terms of funding its arts programs relative to where the state has been and maybe where other states are.
Well, the arts community in Arizona suffered badly during the recession. We saw state funding at one point drop to almost zero. Local funding sources like the city of Phoenix also dropped to almost nothing, and that had an impact. But the private sector also cut funding to the arts. But since then, over time, we have seen quite a bit of recovery there. But we still are not where we were before the recession in 2008. But what has happened is that arts and culture organizations have really started to look at the work that they do in a different way. They're extraordinarily resilient. So they've really learned to do their business differently in an environment of scarcer resources.
Joseph, how do you make the pitch to either government, state, city, county, whatever, or to private entities that the arts, amongst all the other things in the state that need money, the arts are worthy of that kind of support?
Well, before I make that pitch and kind of tell you some of my ideas, I'd like to take a moment, if it's okay, just to say who I am, because for me, that's part of the pitch. But I'm a poor white kid who grew up with a single mom, 2 boys. We were on food stamps, public education, public transportation, and the only arts we got was the arts we got in school. So I'm a product of this, and the arts are literally what kept me in school. I was actually going to drop out my senior year, and auditioning for the school play is literally the one thing that kept me going to school. And I graduated as a result of that and then came to ASU, and my career is kind of on paper since then. So when I speak passionately about the arts, just I want people to know that I'm a product of the arts, and I think I'm a somewhat productive member of society. So in terms of, you know, what that pitch is, so it's not going to come from me. Sometimes it will, but it's going to come from hopefully from the rest of the arts organizations and artists and communities and businesses around the state. So the pitch is going to be a little bit different for each person. You know, some people, everybody responds to either a passion or proof. For some people, it's just really showing the data that we have, which is really clear on the economic impact of the arts to the tunes of hundreds of millions or billions if you add in the whole creative sector. But the other side of that pitch is the personal stories like mine.
When you talk about your experience with arts in schools, and Rusty mentioned some of the problems during the recession, arts in schools were one of the main areas that got cut with all the K-12 education funding. How big of a priority is it to you to both maybe reintroduce dedicated arts programs in schools, but also encourage other arts organizations to do programming in schools?
I know that's a priority for me, and I think it's something that Rusty has already led really well. Because if we are not giving kids a foundation of arts in schools, we're missing a literal cornerstone of education. The arts are not a faucet that can be turned on and off. You have to cultivate it. So we need to give kids the opportunity to participate in that at an early stage, whether or not they want to become artists, or whether or not they want to become accountants, and still go support the arts.
Yeah, and I would add, you know, for people who want quantitative proof, we know there's just reams of research on the impact of arts education on students and on schools. Students perform better, absenteeism goes down, school completion rates go up. They make schools better.
Rusty, Joseph mentioned that it's not a faucet. You can't turn it off and turn it on again. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, after the Great Recession, after the worst of it anyway, and mm-hmm. funding started coming back to state agencies, mm-hmm. was it difficult to get arts to where they had been and maybe where they had been on a path to get to, given that they had lost so much funding?
Yes. I mean, that has been the primary challenge of this organization for my whole tenure, is operating in a political environment where we needed to demonstrate the value of the arts to legislators who pass budgets, legislators who are still concerned about tight state revenues, have lots of other competing priorities. One of the ways we've done that, though, is not simply to demonstrate the economic value, but to talk about what's going on in local communities. And to the point of recovery, in some of our smaller communities, they are looking at the arts to revitalize their downtowns. So the arts are a solution in some communities and have been in some communities to revitalization.
Yeah, if I can add on to that, and I don't want to go off on a tangent here because I'm going to talk a little bit about Roosevelt Row and development, but arts as the solution and arts as leading development is true in every successful city everywhere. You know, we have this case statement right now in downtown Phoenix at Roosevelt Row, where I spend a lot of time, you know, where we saw artists going in there over 30 years ago, activating, you know, empty spaces and blighted neighborhoods. But that same model has existed, you know, as long as, you know, sort of the modern U.S., you know, economy has existed, because you also saw it in New York. You've seen it in neighborhoods in Chicago. You've seen it in multiple cities across California, where the arts go in first. And they build a community. And again, it's because we're going in and we like to be creative and we use spaces in a way that they weren't designed. So after the arts move in, then you see the bars and restaurants move in. And then you see the retail move in. And then you see development come. Mm-hmm. And you can see that same model across the country. And that's part of what I want us to be better at as an arts sector in telling that story.
Is it a different model, though, in a place like Roosevelt Row in downtown Phoenix, one of the biggest cities in the country, versus a place like Bisbee or Yuma, or even a more rural town that's not in a big metro area?
I think if we take the sort of case studies of our own Arizona cities, it's not that different. Of course, there's going to be a little bit difference in terms mm-hmm. of what the art is. You know, Metro Phoenix has a lot of theaters, and Jerome, you know, has a few more, you know, galleries. So the actual arts themselves might look different, but I think, again, looking at Arizona, there are really, really clear success stories of the arts leading that.
Well, I think one of the keys, especially I think when you get out of the urban areas, is that in these some of these smaller communities, they're using arts, they're doing art for their local communities. And as it grows, it may become a tourist attraction. It may be the reason that you spend an extra, you know, half day in the Verde Valley, or, you know, gee, Globe is developing an arts center for their young people. So some of that dynamism comes from the desire to engage local citizenry and bring, you know, people into their small downtowns.
I'm curious what you each think is the ultimate potential of the arts in Arizona.
Wow. I'm not sure how you ultimately would measure this, but to something that Joseph's been discussing here, the arts are not considered a sector of our community, a sector of our economy, the way other sectors are. But they are every bit as much of a contributor to community life and to the vitality of our state as any other sector. And that the impact that arts can have on the whole vitality of a community should be really important to the business community. So I think an appreciation of the role that arts plays in the whole ecosystem of our community would be good.
Joseph, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's telling that story. You know, the future of Arizona is what I've been saying for a long time, is that this is a land of opportunity. So it's really supporting the stories that are already there. You know, when you're in the arts community, like we are, you often know about everything that happens because, you know, you get the emails and your friends' Facebook feeds and whatever that is. So how do we get it to the point where the rest of the world, the rest of the country knows how beautiful and powerful, you know, Arizona arts and culture is? And that's important because otherwise you're going to leave the kids like me growing up and all the kids around the state out in the cold without any opportunities. So when we tell our stories about what's already happening and has been happening in Arizona for so long, then we'll see a change because that messaging will change.
All right. Joseph Benesch is the incoming director of Arizona Citizens for the Arts. He'll be replacing Rusty Foley, who is going to be retiring at the end of the month. Guys, thanks to you both for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Mark.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.